Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next 60 minutes, I will be reading you the news headlines from the AP Network Newswire for Tuesday, August 18th, 2026. We are into the last half of August, which means the end of summer is closing in. It's been a weird summer if you're in Massachusetts, either very hot or somewhat rainy, not enough rain, that's for sure, judging by my vegetables. But that's another matter. We could have a whole hour talk on my vegetable garden. So we're going to jump into the news, and let's see what we can learn over the next 60 minutes. The headline of the first story reads, "Ship attacked during the Strait of Hormuz transit and other news from the Middle East." A projectile hit a ship as it sailed out of the Strait of Hormuz early Tuesday, according to the British military's UK Maritime Trade Operations Center, and an Iranian official said the waterway would not be reopened until the United States meets Iran's conditions. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the attack highlights the danger of attempting to transit the strait as Iran throttles shipping traffic, even as it finalizes negotiations with Oman on a plan to manage the passage that's critical to global supplies of oil and natural gas. An unidentified projectile damaged the ship's engine room and resulted in a crew casualty off the coast of Oman, the UK MTO said, citing a report from the company's security office. The Maritime Monitoring Agency did not release any details about the ship or its cargo, and it was not clear whether the crew member was killed or wounded. It said the Omani Coast Guard was assisting other crew members and authorities were investigating. There's been a growing concern about oil spilling into the Persian Gulf and other area waters from vessels damaged as they attempt to transit the strait. The UK MTO said no environmental damage has been reported in the latest attack. Iran effectively closed the strait, through which roughly one-fifth of the world's traded oil supplies passed before the war and after Israel and the U.S. attacked the country on February 28th. The U.S. is currently blockading Iranian shipping traffic through the strait. Iran's paramilitary speaker and negotiator in previous talks with the U.S., Mohammad Bagher Khalibaf, reiterated on Tuesday that Tehran plans to maintain its grip on shipping traffic until Washington meets Iran's conditions. Until the United States fulfills its commitments under the agreement, including lifting the blockade, releasing frozen assets, lifting oil sanctions, ending threats and military operations on all fronts, and implementing the other conditions to which it committed, the Strait of Hormuz will not reopen, he said. With negotiations between the U.S. and Iran stalled, Iran has been holding separate talks with Oman on a plan to manage ships transiting the strait and said on Monday it was finalizing details for a joint statement. U.S. President Donald Trump reacted angrily, reportedly telling Fox News reporter Trey Yingst in a telephone interview that the U.S. would bomb Oman if it gets in the way. Following a meeting between Egyptian Foreign Minister Badr Abdeldadi and Omani counterpart Badr al-Busadi, the Egyptian foreign ministry said Tuesday that the Iranian-Omani deal could pave the way for Washington and Tehran to return to negotiations for a comprehensive and permanent deal that addresses all concerns and enhances regional security and stability. The statement did not address Trump's latest threat against Oman. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed they fired drones at an oil refinery in neighboring Saudi Arabia, the latest attack threatening to reignite Yemen's civil war and open another front in the Middle East. The attack targeted a facility run by Saudi Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company, according to a report by the Houthi-run SABA news agency. There were no immediate reports of damage or comment from Saudi Arabia. The Houthis have escalated attacks against government forces in Yemen and oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, which supports the Yemeni government, and the kingdom's shipping in the Red Sea, an important alternative to the Strait of Hormuz. At least 17 Yemeni civilian deaths have been reported in government-controlled areas in Yemen as a result of rebel attacks since August 6th, while two casualties were reported in Houthi-controlled areas in late July, the United Nations said on Monday. Excuse me. I got to apologize. I'm just getting over a cold that's been lingering for a few days, so I apologize for that. Back to the news, at least 17 Yemeni civilian deaths. We've read that. The attacks included a Houthi missile strike on an internally displaced persons camp in Marib province and an August 11th attack on a cargo ship in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which killed four crew members and injured several others. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan urged Trump in a telephone call to continue to seek a diplomatic solution to the conflict with Iran. The call came late Monday as the 60-day negotiating period to find a peace deal between the United States and Iran was expiring, with no word of an extension and both sides seemingly as far apart as they were at the start. President Erdogan said it is important to make maximum use of diplomacy amid tensions between Iran and the United States, according to a statement from the Turkish Presidential Communications Office. Turkey, a NATO member that borders Iran, earlier this month signed a joint defense agreement with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which stipulates that any armed attack against any one of the three states shall be regarded as an attack against them all. Trump has praised the agreement, saying that it shows how the Middle East is coming together and how countries will finally be able to defend themselves in a more meaningful way. Erdogan told Trump the deal reflected a strong stance to ensure regional stability and security. So that's a little update on what is going on in the Iran, in the war between Israel, the United States, and Iran. Let's take a look at this story. It's another trial of social media, which have become more and more common over the last few months. The headline of this story is opening arguments are set to begin in Meta's federal trial over child safety. Excuse me. Opening arguments are set to kick off Tuesday in a pivotal trial for Meta platforms in a California federal court. Attorneys from California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey are seeking extensive financial damages plus changes as to how the company operates Facebook and Instagram. 29 states sued the tech giant in 2023 over child safety and privacy. The other 25 will go to trial later. The company also faces lawsuits in state courts. This lawsuit accuses the social media giant of contributing to the youth mental health crisis by knowingly and deliberately designing features that addict children to its platforms. It also argues that Meta routinely collects data on children under 13 without their parents' consent in violation of federal law. This week, we are in court with the largest consumer protection lawsuit in American history. We will show a jury that Meta concealed what it knew about the harm its products cause young people because looking away was more profitable, Kentucky Attorney General Russell Coleman said in a written statement. Meta said it believes it has a strong case. We are proud of our record in protecting teens on our platforms and the amount of effort that we put into developing protections over the years, even before these cases were ever filed, and continuing to do so to the present day. We look forward to showing the judge and the jury those facts in court, the company said in a written statement. U.S. District Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers in Oakland will oversee the proceedings, which are expected to last 6 to 8 weeks, with testimony from Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg and other executives and former employees. Gonzalez-Rogers, appointed to the bench by President Barack Obama in 2011, has overseen a bevy of complex, high-profile cases involving big tech. These include Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI and its founders, as well as Epic Games' lawsuit against Apple over its App Store. This trial is the latest in an avalanche of lawsuits against Meta platforms and other social media companies, including Google's YouTube, TikTok, and Snap, over arguments that their platforms harm young people, illegally collected their data, and are deliberately designed to addict them. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of that particular case will be. Let's see. Here's a story about the tariffs that have been threatened to be imposed upon Canada. The headline of the story reads, U.S. and Canada hold last-minute talks to stop Trump's 50% tariffs. The U.S. and Canada are negotiating in an effort to reach a truce to reach a truce on tariffs before 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday, the deadline set by U.S. President Donald Trump. If no deal is reached, Trump has threatened to impose 50% tariffs on $20 billion worth of Canadian products, ranging from hockey sticks to tongue depressors. "We're negotiating," Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney told reporters on Monday, speaking in French. "The negotiations are very intense and delicate. This is not the time to talk about negotiations in public." The two countries have wrangled for decades over trade, poking each other over sore spots like Canadian softwood lumber imports and U.S. access to Canada's protected dairy market. Still, they somehow managed to remain friends and allies and trading partners. Canadian soldiers fought alongside Americans in Afghanistan after 9/11. The 5,525-mile U.S.-Canada border is undefended, and nearly 330,000 people and $2 billion worth of goods cross it every day. 800,000 Canadians live in the United States. Trump's belligerent approach to dealing with Canada marks an extraordinary departure from the traditionally cooperative relationship between these two countries. Trump has hit Canadian goods with tariffs in a push to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and has repeatedly made inflammatory comments about turning Canada into America's 51st state. The Canadian public is fed up. A petition to expel the U.S. ambassador, a Trump ally, has collected nearly 218,000 signatures since July 21st. It accuses Ambassador Pete Hoekstra of having normalized Trump's talk of annexing Canada, among other things. Nearly 72% of Canadian goods exports last year went to the United States, and the Trump administration might be wary of imposing a hefty new tariff paid by U.S. importers who try to pass along the cost to consumers via higher prices ahead of November's midterm elections. American voters are already frustrated with the high cost of living. "I don't think either side really wants these tariffs to come into effect," said Ryan Majerus, a partner at King & Spalding and a former U.S. trade official. "There's a pretty strong push on both sides to find an off-ramp here." Majerus said the United States is aiming to get Canada to buy more U.S. military equipment, including F-35 fighters, to take part in Trump's Golden Dome missile defense, and to give the United States more access to critical minerals, thereby reducing America's reliance on tenuous supplies from geopolitical rival China. The Canadians would also like relief from U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as softwood lumber, which America says receives unfair government subsidies. Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his second-term economic agenda. Last year, he imposed double-digit import taxes on almost every country on earth, justifying them by declaring the long-standing U.S. trade deficit a national emergency. The Supreme Court in February ruled that he overstepped his authority, striking down those tariffs and setting the stage for the federal government to pay refunds to importers. Trump immediately looked for other ways to rebuild his tariff wall. Last month, he imposed import taxes of 10 to 12.5% on 59 countries and the European Union, which together account for 99% of U.S. imports, for allegedly failing to have or to enforce restrictions on imports made from forced labor. Then he reached back to the Great Depression to find a cudgel with which to whack Canada, one of his favorite targets. Trump invoked Section 338 of the Tariff Act of 1930 to impose 50% tariffs on products that account for about 5% of Canadian exports to the United States. Nearly a century ago, with the U.S. and the world economies in collapse, Congress passed the 1930 tariff law, imposing hefty taxes on imports from around the world. Known as the Smoot-Hawley tariffs for their congressional sponsors, they are notorious among economists and historians for limiting world commerce and making the Great Depression worse. Section 338 tariffs have never been used before. U.S. trade negotiators traditionally have favored another tool, Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, the provision Trump invoked for last month's forced labor tariffs. Section 338 authorizes the president to impose tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries that have discriminated against U.S. businesses. Unlike Section 301 sanctions, no investigation is required, nor is there any limit on how long the tariffs can stay in place. In announcing the Section 338 tariffs, Trump claimed that Canada discriminates against American exports of autos, alcohol, and cheese. Trump is angry with Canada and China because they were the only countries that punched back with retaliatory tariffs of their own when he slapped levies on their products last year. If a country retaliates against us, we're obviously not going to tolerate that, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer told reporters on Friday at the Iowa State Fair. We will take action. My sense is the Canadians, they want to have a more conciliatory approach, but we'll see. The U.S. is also renegotiating a North American trade pact, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that Trump strong-armed America's neighbors into accepting in his first term. The threat of Section 338 tariffs give the United States leverage to seek fresh concessions from Ottawa. From Carney's perspective, you need USMCA to be renegotiated, said Christopher Gunderman, a fellow in the economics program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can't renegotiate it with a massive trade war going on. But the Canadian public furor over Trump's policies may limit Carney's ability to cut a deal. Canada could retaliate again if the new 50% tariffs take effect, potentially aggravating a trade fight. Canada's government cannot look like it's simply caving to the Trump administration's demands, said Daniel Bland, a political science professor at McGill University in Montreal. Making further concessions without getting something meaningful in return would probably lead to a strong backlash. The risk is for the Carney government to make Canada look weak, and therefore even more vulnerable to future trade and geopolitical bullying on the part of the Trump administration. Dominic LeBlanc, Canada's Minister for U.S. Trade, met with Greer on Monday. He was tight-lipped afterward. The work is continuing, he said, and we continue to do our job. So interesting stories come from our friends in negotiating them with our friends from the North. Let's see. Here's a headline reads, the Supreme Court again rebuffs Trump's push to toss out the $5 million verdict in the E. Jean Carroll case. The Supreme Court on Monday again rebuffed President Donald Trump's push to throw out a jury's $5 million finding that he sexually abused the writer E. Jean Carroll at a New York City department store in the mid-1990s and later defamed her. The Republican president's lawyers had asked the justices to reconsider their refusal to hear his appeal. The court denied Trump's petition, along with several others. It's unusual, although not unheard of, for the court to grant such requests. Trump paid the judgment shortly after the court declined to take up his second appeal in June. Trump and the Justice Department are also asking the High Court to toss out a second Carroll verdict totaling $83 million. They argue he's immune from being sued over comments he made about her in 2019 when he was president. The court has not yet acted on that appeal. Carroll is a longtime advice columnist and former TV talk host. She testified at a 2023 trial that Trump turned a friendly 1990s encounter into a violent attack in the dressing room at Bergdorf Goodman, a luxury retailer across the street from Trump Tower in Manhattan. The jury found Trump liable for defaming Carroll when he denied her allegation in 2022. Carroll's attorney, Robert Kaplan, said they were pleased by the Supreme Court's decision. As a result, the jury's unanimous verdict that Donald Trump sexually assaulted and then defamed E. Jean Carroll is now final and cannot be challenged in any court, Kaplan said in a statement. Trump has continued to deny any wrongdoing. That's a little update on that case. Second time the Supreme Court has turned down the appeal by President Trump. So, story to update what is going on in the war between Russia and Ukraine, and it continues to be not good news. The headline reads, Ukraine aims a drone blitz at Moscow as Russian missiles kill 10 in a Ukrainian village. Ukrainian forces staged one of their biggest drone attacks on Russia since Moscow's invasion more than 4 years ago, firing almost 800 drones just 2 days after launching a similar salvo, officials said on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a Russian missile strike on a village in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region killed at least 10 people and wounded 8 others as the barrage demolished homes, officials said on Tuesday. The warring countries are locked in an escalating duel of long-range aerial attacks, fighting on the roughly 780-mile front line in eastern and southern Ukraine is restricted by large numbers of drones and ground robots threatening troop movements, and neither side is making a significant battlefield progress, analysts say. Over the past year, Ukraine has devised and deployed domestically produced long-range drones for strikes deep inside Russia. Its drone technology has impressed governments and defense manufacturers around the world. Kiev officials aim to make the Russian public feel the war's consequences and pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin into negotiating a peace settlement. Putin has so far shown no sign he intends to stop the invasion. Putin continues to drag out the war instead of accepting Ukraine's realistic ceasefire proposals. and ending the bloodshed, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha said on X. Russian air defenses overnight intercepted 791 Ukrainian drones over a number of Russian regions, as well as annexed Crimea and the Black and the Azov Seas, the defense ministry in Moscow said, in what was the second largest drone attack since January of 2025, according to the AP. More than 600 Ukrainian drones flew toward Moscow region, where 180 were shot down. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyan said he did not provide further details. Officials reported no deaths or major damage. Ukraine has increasingly launched swarms of hundreds of drones in an attempt to overwhelm Russian air defenses. In the Moscow region that surrounds but does not include the Russian capital, 3 people were wounded, said Governor Andrei Vorobyov. 3 people were also wounded in the Ryazan region adjacent to the Moscow region, where 3 private homes were damaged by the attack. The overnight attack started a fire at a warehouse in Wildberries, Russia's largest online retailer in an industrial zone. Ukraine has repeatedly targeted the company's depots, which it says help supply the Russian military. Wildberries said its facility sustained insignificant damage. Coverage of the attack in state and Kremlin-backed Russian media was mostly muted, as is often the case. Russia's main television channels, state-run Russia 1 and Channel 1, did not mention the attack at all in their morning news bulletins. But Russian state news agency RIA Novosti featured it among the main news on its website's homepage, describing it as one of the most large-scale attacks on Moscow since the beginning of the summer. State newspaper Roslyn Gazeta on its website prominently featured a roundup of what Moscow region Governor Andrei Voroboyev reported about the attack on the area, describing it as massive in the headline. Pro-Kremlin tabloid MK featured a news brief about the attack on its homepage. A Russian missile strike on the village of Pechenlyni in Ukraine's Kharkiv region killed 10 civilians, according to preliminary information, said Ole Subanov, the head of the Kharkiv Regional Military Administration. Another 17 people were wounded, he said. Zelensky called it a brutal attack that damaged 10 homes, a cafe, a post office, a store, and at least 7 vehicles, according to Subanov. We will definitely respond to this Russian strike, Zelensky said on social media. Also, 3 people were killed and 3 others were wounded. Excuse me. 3 people were killed and 3 people were wounded over the past day in Russian attacks on Ukraine's Sumy region, including drone strikes and an explosive device blast, according to Ukraine's national police. The UK Defense Ministry said Tuesday that it won't budge from its military support for Kiev after Russia said that Ukraine's reported use of British drones for attacks on Russian soil would bring unidentified consequences for London. Britain stands shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine, and we are committed to providing the equipment Ukraine needs to defend itself against Putin's illegal invasion, a British defense spokesperson said. British newspaper The Sunday Times reported that 2 UK companies made drones used by Ukraine to hit Russia. Following the report, the Russian embassy said in a statement that London's actions will inevitably carry consequences. So that's just a... Sorry about that. That's just a terrible situation over in Ukraine, and it certainly doesn't seem like it's going to get much better very soon. That is for sure. We'll take a look at the world of politics as it's Tuesday, so that must mean more primaries in the United States. And let's take a look at some of the stories in those primaries. What to watch on Tuesday, redistricting scrambles Florida as Alaska pits Dan Sullivan versus Dan Sullivan. As a long and contentious primary season nears its end, attention is turning to Florida, Wyoming, California, and Alaska, where primaries on Tuesday will highlight Republican-led redistricting efforts that have scrambled congressional maps and new battles between the Democratic establishment and the progressive left. Also in the mix are a handful of scandal-plagued candidates, multiple people running with matching last names, and several incumbents at risk of defeat. Here's a closer look at what to watch. Trump-backed Florida Representative Byron Donalds, a rising star in the Republican Party, is running to succeed term-limited Governor Ron DeSantis to become the first black governor of the state. If Donalds wins, he'll become a part of a historic slate of black gubernatorial nominees that includes Republican Representative John James in Michigan and Lisa DeMuth, who defeated pillow-selling conspiracist Mike Lindell in Minnesota. On the Democratic side, David Crowley won a razor-thin primary against a Democratic socialist in Wisconsin, joining... I'm sorry, excuse me. David Crowley won a razor-thin primary against a Democratic socialist in Wisconsin, joining Attorney General Aaron Ford in Nevada, State Representative Jermaine Johnson in South Carolina, and former Atlanta Mayor Akeisha Lance Bottoms, who is running in Georgia to become the nation's first black woman governor. There is currently only one black governor in the nation, Democrat Wes Moore of Maryland, who is seeking re-election in November. The Florida GOP winner will likely face David Jolly, a former Republican turned independent turned Democrat. A GOP-led redrawing scrambled Florida's congressional map, which has created some awkward matchups. The most contentious pits veteran Democratic U.S. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz against former U.S. Representative Sheila Sherfilis McCormick in a South Florida district that is almost majority black. Sherfilis McCormick resigned earlier this year under threat of House ethics sanctions, but now she wants her seat back. Wasserman Schultz, a former National Party chair seeking a 12th term in Congress, is the only white candidate competing against four black candidates in an area of Broward County that has helped send black Democrats to Congress since 1992. Her decision to run has raised questions about representation and stirred deep animosity, including charges by one rival that she stabbed us in the back. The race to fill Donald's House seat features a cast of characters akin to a reality show reunion, including several who have spent time in prison and a handful who have run in other states. The field includes two former members of Congress who are mounting comeback bids after departing in scandal. Former North Carolina Representative Madison Cawthorn's tenure was marred by repeated traffic stops, guns at airport checkpoints, and a claim he had been invited to a Washington orgy. Former New York Representative Chris Collins, who resigned before pleading guilty to insider trading charges, served prison time before he was pardoned by Trump. Trump-endorsed Catalina Loeff ran twice for Congress in Illinois. She lost the 2020 primary to Jim Oberweis, a former state senator, who has also decamped to Florida and is running for the seat. You just can't make this stuff up. That's my editorial comment. It's just amazing. Let's see. Another candidate, Ola Hamopteth, previously ran unsuccessfully for Congress in New York, while Linda Sawyer once tried in Michigan. Also in the race, John Strand, a former television actor, underwear model, and romance cover model, who served time in prison for his role in the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol. The internal battle between progressive and establishment candidates that has been roiling the Democratic Party in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan now arrives in a more conservative territory. Progressive state lawmaker Angie Nixon is facing retired Army Colonel Alex Vindman, a former National Security Council official who delivered searing testimony against Trump in his 2019 impeachment trial. They are both running in the Florida special election to fill the last 2 years of Secretary of State Mark Rubio's former Senate term. The winner is likely to face interim Senator Ashley Moody, the Republican appointed by DeSantis to the seat. Other races will put fault lines on display. In South Florida, U.S. Representative Gerald Moskowitz is running for re-election in a new Republican-friendly district against union organizer and Democratic socialist Oliver Larkin. Meanwhile, Republican incumbents are facing their own challenges. Representative Corey Mills, running for a third term, has been plagued by an ethics investigation stemming from allegations of assault, domestic violence, and campaign finance violations, all of which he denies. In a Senate race that is expected to be one of the country's most closely watched this fall, incumbent Republican Senator Dan Sullivan, a Trump ally, seeking a third term, is facing another candidate named Dan Sullivan. Republicans have argued the second Sullivan, who will be appearing on the ballot as Daniel J. Sullivan Jr., is a sham candidate running at the behest of Democrats to cause confusion. Dan J. Sullivan Jr. is a retired teacher, and he has denied the charge. Also in the race is former U.S. Representative Mary Peltola. She was the first Alaska Native to serve in Congress, and she would become the first Alaska Native senator if she wins in November. Under Alaska's open primary system, all candidates appear on the same ballot, and the four who receive the most votes move on to a ranked vote general election. There are other surnames for Alaskans to keep straight. Republican Representative Nick Begich faces a crowded field in his bid for a second term in the state's lone congressional seat. His uncle, former State Senator Tom Begich and former State Rep. Jonathan Christ Tompkins are the two Democrats in the race for governor. Tom Begich is the brother of Mark Begich, a former Democratic U.S. Senator whom Sullivan defeated in 2014. So I would just ask, raise your hand if you're confused about Alaska's ballot. And then we have Wyoming. For the first time in more than 30 years, Wyoming has opened seats for governor, U.S. Senate, and U.S. House all up for grabs in a state where registered Republicans outnumber Democrats by a 7-1 margin. Republican Senator Cynthia Lummis's decision to retire after a single term has set off a chain reaction with Representative Harriet Hagman running to replace her. She has an overwhelming fundraising advantage and became well known after defeating former Representative Liz Cheney, one of Trump's harshest Republican critics, in 2022. Nine Republicans, meanwhile, are competing to replace Hagman as the state's lone U.S. representative. Wyoming's current governor, Republican Mark Gordon, considered seeking a third term and challenging a state term limit, but ultimately decided not to. In California's Bay Area, voters will be picking a replacement for Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell, whose resignation amid sexual assault allegations ended his run for governor. California's 14th district will remain under Democratic control as State Senator Aisha Wahab and Bay Area Rapid Transit Board President Melissa Hernandez advanced from a special open primary. The race is reprising a theme that cropped up in other Democratic primaries this year, outside spending, particularly from pro-Israel lobbying groups. The American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, Super PAC, has spent more than $2 million against Wahab and backing Hernandez, and another group with funding from the Super PAC has spent nearly $2 million in support of Hernandez. Pro-Israeli groups pro-Israel group spending seemed to backfire in Michigan's recent Democratic state primary, where Abu El-Sayed emerged victorious, despite tens of millions of dollars backing his opponent, Representative Haley Stevens. Did you get all that? It's a lot going on. It's only four or five primaries, but there's a lot to watch for. And certainly if you are a political junkie at all, you've got to love this time of the year. I know just watching TV, we are already getting ads for, well, I guess it's probably the primary. A lot of candidates from both New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Be a lot to pick from when it comes November 3rd. Let's see here what we've got here. This is a sad story to come out of Nashville, Tennessee. Let me find it first here. Headline reads, Hayden Panettiere, who starred in Heroes in Nashville, dies at 36 years old. Hayden Panettiere, a one-time child star who soared to fame in the TV shows Heroes and Nashville, while enduring struggles with alcohol addiction and depression, has died. She was 36 years old. Police said Panettiere was found unresponsive in an apartment in Greenville, South Carolina, shortly before 2 p.m. on Sunday. Life-saving measures were performed, but she was pronounced dead at the scene. No cause of death has been determined, and Panettiere's death remains under investigation. An autopsy found no signs of trauma, and police said officers saw no signs of foul play. The television and film performer, who would have turned 37 on Friday, has been open about her private battles and wrote at length about them in the memoir This Is Me, which came out in May. She described lifelong scars from her early fame and acknowledged being addicted to alcohol and enduring postpartum depression after the birth of her daughter Kaya with Ukrainian boxer Volodymyr Klitschko in 2014. It is with profound sadness that we share the tragic passing of our beloved Hayden, her father Skip Panettiere said. said in a statement provided to ABC, she was an incredible light and a force of nature who brought immeasurable love and joy to all who knew her and to the millions who watched her on screen. A publicist for Panettiere did not provide any additional details in response to inquiries from the AP. Panettiere is one of two children born to Skip Panettiere, a former New York City fire captain, and Leslie Vogel, a former soap opera star who had been the prime force behind her early career before the two became estranged. Panettiere began acting in commercials and soap operas, including as the ever-troubled Lizzie Spaulding on Guiding Light. In This Is Me, she wrote that the traumas her character endured, from being kidnapped to killing her mother's boyfriend, led her to associate catastrophe with adoration. Grown-ups gave me positive attention when, as an actor, I failed or got sick, screamed and cried, killed, grieved and suffered, she wrote. Is it any wonder why I've faced so many real struggles in my life? I have often wondered whether, unintentionally, I have brought on my traumas because I'm wired to think that they're good for me. She had much warmer memories of her role as a cheerleader with Supernatural Powers and Heroes, which propelled her to fame in 2006. The series revolved around the mantra, save the cheerleader, save the world. I think Heroes is really hot because it's just a really great combination of everything that people love. They love reality, they love sci-fi, and things like X-Men, where they get to dream of something bigger, Panettiere told the AP in 2008. And at the core of it are these human stories that people can relate to. Very rugged. And it just grabbed everyone in every age group. She went on to win 3 Teen Choice Awards for that role and was nominated for a Grammy for a children's spoken word album, also voicing a role in the Disney animated movie A Bug's Life. Excuse me. Panettiere later played a brash country upstart opposite Connie Britton on Nashville, which aired on NBC for 4 seasons before being canceled and revived on CMT. She did her own singing in the show, which scored some hits on country charts, spawned U.S. tours, and earned Panettiere 2 Supporting Actress Golden Globe nominations. 11 songs that Panettiere recorded for Nashville appeared on Billboard's Hot Country Songs charts during the show's run, including 2 featuring Britton. Panettiere's daughter, now 11 years old, began living with Klitschko full-time in Ukraine when she was 2 years old. At the time, the actor was struggling with mental health and addiction. I think there's been this very common misconception that I just gave up my child, she said in an interview with podcaster Jay Shetty in May. That could not be farther from the truth. She said she was in a horrible cycle for years of battling depression and anxiety and alcoholism and substance abuse while just trying to find my way back, my way out of the darkness. She entered rehab in 2015 while filming Nashville. I was the one who put myself in the first treatment center. Excuse me. I was drowning, she said in a 2023 interview with Women's Health magazine. Panettiere has endured numerous family struggles and tragedy. Her parents' marriage was strained and eventually ended. Her younger brother, Jansen Panettiere, who was also an actor, died of a heart condition in 2023 at age 28. Years earlier, Hayden had made the painful decision to part professionally with her mother, who throughout her childhood had defined and driven her and watched her struggle, learn, grow, fall apart, and triumph. She and I spent so much time together, so deeply enmeshed in each other's lives, that we started grating on each other, Panettiere wrote in her memoir. I hated when Mom whispered about other actors during auditions, positive that they could hear her compare them to me. I hated when Mom went to industry parties and got tipsy on the Merlot she loved. In recent years, she had been in a tumultuous relationship with actor Brian Hickerson. On Shetty's podcast, Panettiere recalled how she exploded in the public eye through Heroes, including the first time she was tracked by the paparazzi. She described her response as sheer terror. In her memoir, she would remember unwanted encounters with fellow celebrities, from an Oscar-winning actor-director exposing himself to her to being forced into bed with a famous 30-something British singer-songwriter. She had spoken positively about her experience filming Remember the Titans, saying she felt similar to the character she played, Cheryl Yost, the opinionated, football-loving daughter of Will Patton's coach, Bill Yost. Panettiere also appeared in two of the Scream movies and starred as the title character in the 2009 film I Love You, Beth Cooper. In her memoir, Panettiere described herself as an optimist to the core who refused to be defined by tragedy. One thing I know from my 36 years in the public eye is this. Life is a process that evolves day by day, year by year, and like it or not, you are engaged in a cycle of growth until the moment you take your last breath, she wrote. So quite a sad story to read, that young, very talented actress dead at 36 years old, and what a life she had as a young actress, the roles she played, and how that all figured into the person she became. So it's just incredible to look at, read some of those stories. That is for sure. Let's see what we've got here. We'll take this, an interesting story to read. The headline reads, Luigi Mangione's state murder trial postponed indefinitely amid double jeopardy fight. So Luigi Mangione's state murder trial in the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, which was slated to begin September 8th, has been postponed indefinitely as his lawyers seek to have the case thrown out on double jeopardy grounds, following his guilty plea last week to federal charges. Judge Gregory Caro issued an order Monday canceling the trial and giving the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which is prosecuting the state case, until October 9th to respond to the defense's double jeopardy claims. A hearing will be held on December 10th, Caro said, about a week before Mangione is scheduled to be sentenced in the federal case. Mangione pleaded guilty Friday in Manhattan federal court to a pair of stalking charges and admitted trailing Thompson to United Health Group's investor conference and gunning him down outside a Manhattan hotel in 2024. Federal prosecutors said they would seek life in prison when Mangione is sentenced on December 18th, though federal sentencing guidelines call for a term of 24 to 30 years. On the morning of December 4th, 2024, I shot Mr. Thompson in Manhattan and he died, Mangione said. Immediately after his plea, Mangione's lawyers filed paperwork seeking to have the state case thrown out on double jeopardy and due process grounds. They described him as a pawn in parallel prosecutions and accused state and federal prosecutors of trying to punish him twice for the exact same conduct. Mangione has pleaded not guilty in the state case, which also carries the possibility of a life sentence. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office said in a statement that it would fight efforts to end the state case in part because Mangione's federal sentence isn't yet known. Compared with federal law and that of other states, New York has an uncommonly strong protections for defendants facing multiple prosecutions. A state prosecution can be barred if a federal case involving the same course of conduct or criminal transaction ends in a guilty plea or if a jury is sworn. It will be up to Caro to decide if that applies to Mangione. However, Caro rules his decision will be subject to appeal. Mangione pleaded guilty to federal charges that accused him of traveling across state lines by bus to stalk and kill Thompson. The charges allege that he used a cell phone, the internet, interstate highways, and a hostel serving out-of-state customers to plan and carry out the attack. The full range of conduct that comprises the stalking offenses coterminous with the conduct committed as part of the murder offense, Mangione's lawyers wrote in their double jeopardy filing. That Mangione traveled from out of state to be at the crime scene at the time of the shooting does nothing to eliminate the stalking of Mr. Thompson from the acts of constituting his murder, they added. They are all part of the same criminal incident or criminal transaction. Bragg's office contends that the state charges, including murder and firearms offenses, involve different legal elements and criminal conduct. In a letter last month, Assistant District Attorney Joel Seideman objected to the possibility of a federal guilty plea wiping out the state case. Any guilty plea, Seideman wrote, must account for the seriousness of the defendant's offenses and for the state's interest in prosecuting Mangione, including the sanctity of life principle that underpins the state homicide charges. So, interesting strategy from Mangione's lawyers as he seeks to, looks like he pled guilty to the federal charges, yet to be sentenced. Looks like that's going to happen in December. And now his lawyers are appealing the state trial, saying that it is basically double jeopardy. So we'll see what comes of that decision. Take a look at a local story. The headline reads, Mom and Sister Testify About Lindsay Clancy's Declining Mental State Before She Killed Her Children. Lindsay Clancy's mother and sister took the stand on Monday to recount how they saw her become increasingly anxious, paranoid, and suicidal in the months before she killed her three children. Clancy's mother, Paula Musgrove, sounding at times emotional, described her daughter as a dedicated and loving mother whose mental health began declining in October 2022, about 3 months before Clancy strangled the children and attempted to kill herself. Mom, will you please come up and stay with me for a bit? I'm really sick. Something is wrong, Clancy wrote in a text message displayed to the jury. I had horrible insomnia all night, and I just don't know how I'm going to get through the day. It's just really scary, and I don't want to be alone. Musgrove also recalled a more alarming disclosure in December. Excuse me. When she was standing in the kitchen with Clancy and her then-husband, Patrick Clancy, Musgrove said her daughter appeared nervous and told them she needed to tell them something. She told us that she had thoughts of harming her children, Musgrove wrote. Musgrove, who lives in Connecticut, often stayed with her daughter in Massachusetts from October into December 2022. She said Clancy was scared of sleeping alone, became increasingly paranoid, and believed the medications she was taking were destroying her mind. Clancy's sister described a similar decline. Allison Osga testified that at the end of December, Clancy told her she had experienced suicidal thoughts every day for a month. The testimony came in the fourth week of Clancy's murder trial, soon after the prosecution rested their case. Prosecutors argue that Clancy, a former labor and delivery nurse, planned the January 24, 2023 killings and contrived to get her husband out of the house by sending him to get takeout and to the pharmacy. Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, does not dispute that she killed the children, but he says... But he says she shouldn't be held criminally responsible because she had postpartum psychosis, a rare mental illness linked to the stress, sleep deprivation, and hormonal changes that follow childbirth. He also said she had bipolar disorder and that antidepressants prescribed worsened that condition. A former co-worker testified on Monday about Clancy's years as a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital, describing Clancy as a really good nurse who loved her job and was compassionate, kind, and a patient advocate. She was the type of nurse that you wanted taking care of you or your loved one when you walked into our unit, said Margaret Hamp. Hamp said she and Clancy worked night shifts together and that Clancy regularly sought parenting advice from her co-workers, asking about everything from children's sleeping habits and choosing a daycare provider to monogrammed lunchboxes. Hamp also recalled a conversation from Clancy's first year on the unit after a pregnant patient arrived with plans to harm herself. Hamp said she spoke with Clancy about mental health during pregnancy and postpartum and asked whether she had heard of Andrea Yates, the Texas mother who drowned her five children in 2001. "I explained that to her and she cried," Hamp testified. She said, "How could a mother hurt her children?" Earlier in the trial, the jury heard that Clancy had sought treatment for severe mental health problems, including admitting herself to a psychiatric hospital. But witnesses also noted Clancy wouldn't always take the medications prescribed to help with her insomnia, anxiety, and depression, and that she expressed fears she was addicted to some of them. The defense has argued that Clancy was over-medicated and that her care was disjointed, with doctors not speaking to one another or sharing notes. The defense also showed she was discharged from one facility after a day and denied a higher level of care at another when she couldn't show that she had a suicide plan. Prosecutors have questioned the seriousness of Clancy's suicide attempt and showed through texts and photos that she performed many normal activities the day of the killings, including taking her children to the doctor and playing with them in the snow. Her doctors have testified they never saw Clancy exhibit signs of mania or psychosis, though she did repeatedly talk of feeling suicidal. Clancy hasn't testified and isn't required to do so, but jurors have seen her break down in sobs at several points, including when prosecutors showed the jury autopsy photos of the children. There's more to read in this article, but we're coming up to a time thing. The rest of the article really goes over Patrick Clancy's testimony when he came home from going to the pharmacy and to the restaurant and finding his wife in the driveway and his three children dead. So just a horrible story. I hate to end on that note, but we have unfortunately reached the end of our hour together. I want to thank you for listening. I hope you have enjoyed the articles I've selected to read. I hope you have found them interesting as well as enjoyable. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many, many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.